The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Good afternoon. Hope you are having a great day. 51551 for your text or ray@rte.ie for your emails. Get in touch because we love having a chat with you throughout the show. I am on my third cup of coffee today and I thought I was all boxed off last night, had a nice hot bath, got into the bed at 10:30, fresh sheets on the bed, you know, that lovely, clean, laundered feeling. Headed off to the Landonnade, 3:30 this morning. It wasn't my child who woke me up. The dog barking the entire house down. Probably woke the entire estate as well and had to get up and go down. And he just wanted to go out into the garden. He didn't need to go to the toilet. He just wanted to go have a sniff around. I'm standing in the garden waiting for him to... He's been acting a little unusual of late. And I don't know, I've talked to a couple of doggy people and I think it could be the muggy weather maybe. But he certainly is kind of, his sleep pattern has altered a little bit. Anyway, I'll be talking to a dog behaviour expert later on. So she might shed some light on the subject for me. And then, of course, to top it all off, I opened the papers today to read that coffee actually doesn't keep you awake. You know, you're told never go near a cup of coffee before bed. Like, you wouldn't think twice of a glass of wine on Thursday or Friday evening. A new study revealed alcohol is far more likely to lead to a night of tossing and turning than caffeine. Researchers tracked the sleep of 800 people over six nights and asked them if they'd had caffeine, alcohol or nicotine in the 4 hours before bed. Almost half of those surveyed, which I found unusual if you're doing a sleep survey anyway, had almost half had caffeinated drinks and no link to interrupted sleep compared to those who smoked and drank where they were awake for an extra 8 minutes. There you go. But I suppose it's how much caffeine and how much alcohol you drink. But let me know, some people have a cup of coffee before bed, absolutely no bother. I don't know that a whole lot. I know a load of people who have a cup of tea and head off to the bed. So let me know, 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Have you been drinking coffee for years and looking at us all going, no problem? Or do you have any little tricks or tips to ensure a good night's sleep? As I said, I thought I was boxed off. The hot bath and the fresh linen normally does it for me. I tell you, I do have a trick. Don't get a dog. That's my tip of the day. What else did I like in the paper? Oh, yes, in the Herald today. Secrets are bad for our health. That's according to new research. On average, each of us is carrying 13 secrets at any one time. And when you read the piece, the secrets that they're talking about are the secrets that we hold that maybe make us feel guilty or ashamed. They're the ones which are bad for our health, which is understandable. And we all know some people are better at keeping secrets than others. Like, in general, I'm very good at keeping other people's secrets, not so good at keeping my own. Actually, pretty useless. Pádraic bought me this gorgeous piece of jewellery years ago and I absolutely loved it, but I lost it. And did I tell him? No. Did I tell him after 3 months? No. Did I tell him after 6 months? No. 9 months. And then, because I was trying to maybe see, could I get a replica? And then the guilt just got too much. So, of course, I had to confess. Yeah, it's secrets like that, I suppose. But then you've got secrets that people carry to the grave, you know, where the family only find out about big life-altering secrets after. And you wonder how somebody lived and died holding that secret forever without anybody knowing. Like pregnancy, that's a secret we all have to keep for a certain amount of time. Although somebody always guesses if you're there looking a bit green or you're the one in the pub with the glass of water. You know, it's hard to keep a pregnancy secret for as long as maybe you'd like to. And then friends of mine, they went off, they got married in Vegas last year. Didn't tell anybody because there were two weddings on both sides, on both the groom and the bride's side. A brother and sister were getting married. And so they said, rather than kind of steal the thunder, went off to Vegas, drive through Little Whitechapel. And then when all the wedding sort of hoo-ha finished up back here, they just played the video for everyone. It was like, oh yeah, we got married months ago. So we all thought that was brilliant. Anyway, today is the day. It might make you feel better if you want to let us into a secret anonymously, however trivial that you've been harboring, it might make you feel a little better. 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Speaking of surprise weddings, you've probably seen Ben Foden. He's all over the papers today. Rugby player. He was married to our very own Una Healy. But anyway, he's in the papers today because he is newly married and he only married his wife 2 weeks after meeting her. So that's kind of unusual, very quick. I mean, how well can you know somebody after just hanging out with them for 2 weeks. Mind you, how well do you know somebody after hanging out with them for 2 years? I don't know. 51551 or ray@rte.ie. I'd love to know, did you have a whirlwind romance with your partner and tie the knot sooner than, I suppose, what's considered normal? But then you look at some couples buy a house after a year together and think nothing of it. And that's a mortgage. That's a marriage for up to 40 years. And then for others, it's, you know, 10 years before they go down that road and make that commitment to each other of buying a house. So let me know your thoughts. 51551 or ray@rte.ie. There seems to be a lot of talk all summer about seagulls, because I know we have a big problem with seagulls, menacing seagulls in Ireland. You know, the ones that are so brazen, they literally swoop in and take your chips or take the sandwich out of your hand. Well, apparently we need to stare these guys down, look them straight in the eye and let them know who's boss. Using a bag of chips for bait, researchers found that 6 out of 9 seagulls, which is almost a third, didn't dare touch the chip when they were being watched. But they all tucked in when the scientists looked away. And then one bird, who was bold enough, took the food within 6 seconds when a researcher was looking away, but waited a full 5 minutes. It did pluck up the courage eventually, but waited a full 5 minutes without touching the chip when she was staring in his direction. So the problem is with staring a seagull down, the stories that you hear are when you're not observing, you're not looking at the seagull. They are literally coming from the sky and taking them out of your hand. Like, there's a friend of mine, he didn't believe this was going to happen at all. He thought, this is nonsense. And he was in McDonald's, coming out of McDonald's on Grafton Street, just about to take the last bite out of the Big Mac. Next thing, gone. So let me know, have you encountered problem seagulls? I don't think there's anybody, whether you live in the city or the countryside, that hasn't. I haven't been the victim of a sandwich swipe yet, but let me know your thoughts. 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Brian has said, Catherine, your dog may have been suffering from thunder fright. There you go. I was probably in such a deep sleep I didn't hear any thunder or lightning or anything last night. But that could be an explanation. If your dog is a male, which he is it likely an unneutered female is on heat and your dog is picking up the scent? There you go. I have a male and a female dog. So not sure there, but hopefully we will be able to shed some light a little bit later on. Anyway, I think it is an afternoon for a bit of Stevie Nicks. What do you reckon? Love that track, I have to say, and that is definitely one of my top 10 tracks for a road trip. I think that's love it. My daughter was walking down Grafton Street eating a jambon when a large seagull actually landed on her head and took the jambon she got, took the jambon out of her hand. She got a terrible fright, says Caroline in Rings End. On Secrets, I am nearly 8 months pregnant and I got away without anyone knowing until last week. Oh, wow. Well done you. I was lucky I wasn't sick. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, if you can get away with it and you can hide it in the clothes nowadays, are so good, you can get away with it a lot longer than maybe people would think. Catherine, I ate all the French fancies and blamed my sister. Somebody else says, I like to cancel plans with my friends so I can stay home and watch movies on Netflix with my dog. Yeah, that's a great one. Then talking about marriage, we were chatting about Ben Foden at the top of the programme, newly married to his wife, who we met 2 weeks ago. And a listener has texted in, I got engaged 4 months after meeting himself. We married 4 years later and we'll be 30 years married next February. You see? We met on March 16th, 2006. We married on July 22nd, 2006. Because we lived in different countries, we'd only spent 34 days together before we got married in Vegas. We had our big Irish wedding in December the following year. 13 years later, I love him more than ever. You see, they're great stories, and it's a reminder that sometimes it's just bang, love at first sight, and it works. And maybe we should all just hold our wished. So lots more coming in then. Dogs, I would suggest your dog probably heard a fox in the garden, Catherine, and that's what woke him. Somebody else said, some years back while visiting family in the UK, we brought an ice cream cone and were walking along Brighton Pier. Out of nowhere, a seagull swooped from behind me and took the cone right out of my hand. That's from John in Malahide. Yeah, and the thing is now they're much more brazen than they were. That's the problem. And we're seeing them in the cities, in streets in the city, and not just out in piers, Brighton Pier and Dunleary Pier and the likes. Anyway, keep them coming in to me, 51551 or ray@rte.ie.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, you can keep your texts coming in to 51551 and your emails to ray@rte.ie. My next guest sent us in a really touching email about her son, Daniel, who lost his life 2 years ago in a road accident. He was only 22 years of age. And Bridget asked us to help her promote an event that she's organising in his memory. So we got in touch to find out more, and we were all, I suppose, very touched is the word, by her positive outlook on life. So Bridget joins me now in studio, and thank you so much for coming in. It's great to see you. How are you feeling today?
Ah, sure, look, we do the best we can. Today, just coincidentally, happens to be Daniel's second anniversary.
I know.
So, you know, we have our good days and our bad days, but it's nice to be invited in here today to promote this charity, you
in
know.
His memory. So tell me about Daniel. He was your only son and, by all accounts, the apple of your eye.
Yeah, my two girls, Amy and Anna, would say he was the favourite son. He was the only son. Daniel was second born, and from the time he arrived, he was just, I suppose, the apple of our eye. He was 22 when he passed away. I suppose, first and foremost, Daniel was our son. He was a brother in a million to the two girls.
What sort of character was he?
Oh my God, he was fun. He lived life to the full. He was that guy who would walk into a room and without even speaking, I mean, we called him Mr. Bean, he could just make you crack up without saying a word. He would give you the shirt off his back. He would give the shirt off his back to a stranger and ask for nothing in return. He was fearless. Daniel was fearless, probably why he had so many broken bones throughout his lifetime, because nothing scared him.
And was he into sport? Or I know he was big into his cars.
He was a massive car enthusiast. He used to play rugby, and he was going back to play rugby again. Cars were pretty much his passion. They were his passion from the time he was a young child. He couldn't wait to get his own car. He had his full driver's license at 17, and he had his first car at 17. And from then on, it was cars in and out of our yard every day.
So can you remember the day he got his first car at 17?
His eyes were popping in his head. He was so thrilled. He was still in school at the time, and he could not wait to be able to drive to the school so as his friends could see his car. Mm. He was absolutely thrilled with himself.
Mm. And were you at any stage nervous about that? Did you do what every mammy does? Be careful, don't go too fast, the whole...
Of course.
Yeah.
I mean...
And did the girls have cars that young?
No. Well, my youngest girl doesn't have one yet.
Right.
She tells me she's working towards it.
Yeah.
My eldest girl didn't have one at 17. She had one later. But I think it's a boy thing. The cars is a boy thing. And yes, of course, I mean, I always would have reservations about any young driver going on the road. But my contribution to Daniel and getting his license and his car was to get him his driving lessons, which I did. So he was a very, very competent and very safe driver on the road.
And even in your email, you attached a picture of him and he was in his favourite place in his car. That was where he loved to be, right?
It was. And funnily enough, that picture is actually taken by his best friend, Nicole, out on the Curra, where we're actually going to do our fun run on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And he just every weekend, every moment he could get, he was out in his car.
And when you say the yard was, there was a full of fellas in under cars, you know, with spanners and in under the bonnet and tinkering away all day, every day.
That was
fixing
constant.
Cars, doing up cars, all of that.
That was constant in our house. I made
and
a
there's
rule.
So many parents around the country who are looking out the window with the exact same thing now, you know, fellas with their cars, and it's an obsession.
It is. But, you know, it gave them a focus.
Mm.
I mean, everyone. There's not one of Daniel's friends would drink or drive, touch drugs or anything like it. They were just, all of their money went into their cars.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it is still today with the rest of the lads. And because we had a fairly sizable yard, everybody could come and park their cars in our house. And when Daniel would say, "Mammy, I'm having a few of the lads around for a few drinks," and 2 hours later I'd look out and there was 30 or 40 people in the back garden.
And all with the engines out on the grass.
Absolutely.
And the whole, yeah.
But they were happy.
And at that time, Bridget, he had just found his place in life. He was a recruit at the 7th Battalion, excuse me, at Cahill Brua Barracks. So that was kind of a new start for him as well.
Oh, it was. I mean, when Daniel was younger, he always said he was going to join the army. Mm-hmm. He was always going to join the army. And I suppose there came a point then where his focus was on his cars, really, and he couldn't envisage himself being away every week. But then after working for a few years, he decided, no, this is where I'm going to head now. So he went for the army. He got it straight away. He was absolutely thrilled. And he was 6 weeks a recruit when he had his car accident.
Okay.
He was on weekend leave on the August bank holiday weekend 2 years ago. And he had spent the evening out with all his car enthusiast mates, had a wonderful evening. And because he had an extra day at hand because it was the bank holiday, he stayed out later than usual. And he was heading for home when he had his accident.
And what happened?
I suppose when you hear of a young driver, and it's most especially a young male driver, when you hear of them having a car accident in the early hours of the morning, and I would be guilty of this too, I suppose one of the first things you would think of is speed,
yeah,
drink, drugs, carelessness, racing. But none of those applied to Daniel.
You got the call in the middle of the night.
Our doorbell rang at 10 to 4 in the morning. And before my feet landed on the floor, my heart sank. I knew there was something terribly wrong. Sorry.
Oh, you're doing great.
And when I went to the front door, his best friend Johnny was there, and I just knew by his face something terrible had happened. So I just said to him, "Where's Daniel?" And he said he had a crash on the Port Road. And I said, "Why is he not with you?" Because I expected him to have a bump. He said, "He's still in it." I knew. Because I knew if there was any way of him getting out of that car, he would have got out, or his friends would have taken him out. So I suppose, to cut a long story short, an awful lot of that time, I really, even still, I don't remember it.
But
it took us, yeah, it took quite a few months for the investigation to be completed. And I mean, all along we kept thinking Daniel was such a competent driver. Where he crashed his car, it just shouldn't have happened. It shouldn't have happened to Daniel because he was such a good driver. And I knew he wouldn't be racing, and I knew he would never take a drink or drive, and I knew he'd have his seatbelt on. And it transpired that a nut fell off his car. One nut did all this. Apparently a nut fell off the steering rack of his car and took the steering away from him. And he just went where the car went. And he impacted a pole.
Okay.
And that was it.
I mean, such a tragic accident to happen. And as you said, the first thing as a mother, even though you don't want to think it, everything goes through your head when you get that knock on the door. And for it, in some way, for it not to have been his fault, you know, not to have been, it wasn't drugs, it wasn't drink, it wasn't speeding. And I suppose that's the message, Bridget, that's why you're here today. It's for any other parents out there, any other moms or dads who have boys like Daniel who are car mad, and rightly so, and it's great that they have that passion. It's to always have a check, have a proper mechanic check cars if they're going to be tinkering away on it themselves. Is that,
well, of course,
is that the message?
Even for the likes of me and everybody else who have cars on the road, to have them regularly checked. I mean, this was one nut that took our Daniel away from us. Mm-hmm. It can happen to anybody. Mm-hmm. But most especially, probably with young drivers and young men who are buying second-hand cars, maybe doing up cars, to be 100% sure of the roadworthiness of them, to be check one another's work. Just keep checking cars. Check your neighbour's car, check your sister's car, check your daddy, your mammy's car for simple things like a loose nut. You know, it shouldn't have happened.
And because if you're not a qualified mechanic, and we all tinker about and we all, you know, it is about getting an expert in their field to, or have another set of eyes, like you're saying.
Of course, of course. Look, it's all about road safety. And it's to keep most of our young drivers. We lose so many young drivers and young males we lose on the roads. And my heart just goes cold any weekend I hear of yet another accident, which, you know, may or may not have been preventable, you know. I mean,
but it's one that we don't hear, that message that you're talking about today. It's one we don't hear very often, because we hear about reducing speed. We hear about, you know, not being on your mobile phone. Yeah. We hear about not drink driving, all the checks that are happening now. But what we don't hear about a whole lot, actually,
is malfunction.
That's
it. I mean, Daniel played everything by the book. He'd done what he was supposed to do. I remember at the inquest, one of the statements that were read out was that the car was in very, very, very good condition, was maintained to an extremely high standard, but this one single nut, one nut caused all of this. So, you know, it's that thing of maintaining our cars, looking after one another, checking on somebody who maybe an older person who can't have that done. Maybe a local mechanic drop in and say, would you like me to have a look at your car? I mean, there's very high profile garages around the country, which I'm sure could give 1 to 2 hours, maybe on a Saturday morning, to give a talk on road safety, give a talk on how the young lads in particular can maintain their cars as safely as possible, you know?
I think I know the answer to this, but if you could go back, would you still let Daniel get his car?
I think if I had taken that joy away from Daniel, he would never have forgiven me. He adored his cars. I mean, so much so. I mean, he loved, when he joined the army, he fell in with such a wonderful bunch of recruits. They gelled so quickly. They were so wonderful. But every weekend, Daniel would come home. He'd open up the garage and he'd pat the bonnet of the car and he'd say, I'm home, baby. Such was his love for cars. He lived for going out with his friends at the weekend. And going out with his friends at the weekend didn't mean petrol heading around the countryside.
Yeah.
They went out, they had dinner, they kicked football, they admired one another's cars as they do. And they're all a very safe, competent group.
Yeah, because it gets a bad rap.
It does. And young drivers get a bad rap. And young drivers with loud exhausts get a bad rap. And it seems, very often seems like they're going so much faster than they actually are. I mean, there's going to be the odd exception, of course.
Well, like anything, you've got good drivers and bad drivers are fast drivers.
But they do get a bad rap. And, you know, every penny they have goes into their cars. It doesn't generally go into any sort of devilment or badness, you know. Mm-hmm. It's their cars they put their lives and souls into.
You thank your lucky stars every day that your daughter Anna wasn't in the car with Daniel, because that night she had planned to go with him.
Yeah, Anna had gone up to visit her daddy on the Saturday. We had attended a funeral on the Saturday and we had all been present, and Anna was to stay with John for the weekend. Then she decided she was going to come back on the Sunday and Daniel was going to go to collect her. But in the meantime, her sister Amy said, well, I'm going up, so we'll all come back together, Amy and Anna, and that Daniel wouldn't have to go for her. So they decided they'd come back on the bank holiday Monday rather than the Sunday. And other than that, I think she would have been out with him that night. That was the prior plan.
So how do you now, sitting here 2 years later, make sense of that?
I don't know. I'm not very superstitious at all. I just hope to God that somebody somewhere was looking out for her. I just hope maybe it was just fate, maybe it was coincidence. I'm not sure. I just thank God every day that she wasn't in that car.
Yeah.
You know?
And she announced her pregnancy shortly after Daniel's death, which kept you going.
Amy. Anna would die if I thought she announced her pregnancy on radio. Amy announced her pregnancy.
Amy announced, okay, apologies.
6 weeks after Daniel passing away. And we were thrilled, of course, you know, and it was something we really needed to grasp onto. And just very coincidentally, she said that she was actually 6 weeks gone in her pregnancy.
Okay.
Which was very it just made my hair stand on end. But, you know, maybe Daniel sent us somebody to help us through it.
It takes somebody like little baby Theo to pull you out and keep you all going at a time when you needed it.
And he is a wonderful little boy. He really, really does that.
Does he keep you on your toes?
Oh gosh, he's wonderful. He's just getting up on the feet now. So,
it's a busy time.
It is indeed. Yes, absolutely.
And Bridget, people told you lots of stories after Daniel's death about the sort of man he was. And you often hear that, you know, stories of your son that you would never have heard before. And then beautiful stories that came back to you about him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't know the girl's name. Somebody contacted Amy by Facebook and she just, you know, she commiserated with her afterwards and said, I didn't realise this was your brother, but she told a story about one night she was driving home from somewhere while heavily pregnant. And some of the lads drove up behind her and she pulled into the filling station and they just said, do you know you have a flat wheel? And she said, I do. And they said they'd help her. But in the meantime, they couldn't get the wheel off. So I think some of them sent for Daniel, pulled them out of the bed to go out to the garage to get the necessary tools to do the job. And sure, he very happily went down to oblige. And she just said, you know, that was the sort of person your brother was. She just felt the need, you know, to tell Amy, and all those little things have been so helpful. I had a beautiful letter from the mother of one of Daniel's fellow recruits last year, just around his anniversary, just to say she was thinking of us still and that Daniel had been such a support and such a help to her son, who was younger than Daniel when he joined as a recruit, and that he had been very, very encouraging to him, had helped him along the way when he was faltering. Daniel picked him up, but that was Daniel anyway. That wouldn't have been anything new to him.
Yeah, not new to you either.
No.
So after Daniel passed away, his colleagues from the Irish Defence Forces, they gave you and your family unwavering support.
Look, on the morning this happened, I suppose I was probably not very capable of doing very much. And the ball had to be started rolling and contacting an undertaker, etc., which we did. But some part of that day, somebody in our house got a phone call from somebody in the Defence Forces asking if they could come down and speak with us. And a wonderful guy called Finian Everard and some of his colleagues arrived down and they offered to either take over the whole organisation of Daniel's funeral or to assist us in any way we saw fit and we wanted. Their help was absolutely unwavering. It has been to this day. Their door is still open to us as a family to ever contact them for whatever reason. Without them, we would have been absolutely lost because they carried us along. It's like they just came and swept us up, nurtured us, helped us, minded us, and they carried out every single duty that had to be carried out to a letter of the T. Daniel was privileged and honoured with a full military burial, which as a six-week-old recruit, never ever entered our heads he could ever have. He would have been just so proud. So we're running this event on Sunday. And it's the only way we can give back.
Well, let me go through the details for people. It is taking place on August the 11th. It's 2:00 on the Curragh Plains. And this is why you wanted to do it, Bridget, because as you said, you're really only getting back on your feet now, I can imagine. And you did so well today, by the way, let me say. I know it's not easy at all. And you want to give back and you want to support. So it's a 5K run. It's called A Blast for Danny. And all the information is on Facebook. We're going to put it up on our website. We'll put all the information there. And it's a fun run that you want to organise.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of poignancy in the fun run at this, because you said he was very fun loving. He said he was the crack when he walked into the room. And I think to open it up to everybody, you don't have to be a sprinter. You can walk,
absolutely,
you can run,
not.
You can crawl, you can bring your dog.
Absolutely.
You can whatever. This is open for everybody. So it's inclusive and it's for everybody. And it's taking place on the Curragh Plains.
On the Curragh Plains, just down beside the Curragh Army Barracks. We organised this with the help of Daniel's best friend, Nicole. Of course, she's been invaluable in the helping of organising this. And It's to raise funds for the Defence Forces Benevolent Fund, and it's been arranged by ourselves and the Defence Forces from the 7th Battalion in Cathal Brua and the Army Barracks in the Curragh. And it's to raise for funds for the Benevolent Fund, which was set up in the early 1930s. It provides support to the veterans and retired members of the Defence Forces, whether that be Army, Navy, Air Corps, to assist those ex-members and their families, not just those ex-members, but it's very inclusive of their families. And I suppose it's a testament really to the continued link and the caring attitude of the Defence Forces towards their ex-members, and the caring nature just shone through for us. I mean, like I asked Finian on that day, why are you doing this for us? Daniel was only 6 weeks a recruit, and he said, well, when Daniel joined, he joined to be part of our family. He said, and in return, he says, you're our family, and that's what we're here to do. The funds for the Benevolent Fund is all raised through charitable events. I know there's voluntary donations made by serving members of the Defence Forces, mm-hmm. but that's voluntary. And so every other penny that's earned for that fund is earned through charity. Mm-hmm. So this is our only little way of saying thank you from the bottom of our hearts to Defence Forces, what they have done for us and continue to do. And so whatever funds, it's a voluntary donation from anybody. We will have little buckets and things on the day, but attached to the event, A Blast for Danny, there is a link for anybody who would like to contribute. And
that's to contribute online if they can't get there on the day.
Absolutely. It's a GoFundMe page online. Yeah. So we'd be very, very, very grateful for anybody who could donate whatever little. And for anybody who can't donate, just come along on the day, enjoy it, join in with us. Anybody who fancies themselves as a runner, I'm quite sure there'll be some of Daniel's Defence Force friends heading off out there. So if you fancy your chances, tip out there and beat their time. Otherwise, it's just fun. It's a family day out. It's a family event. Just come along and enjoy yourselves and remember Daniel in the process.
You are some woman for one woman, I have to say, because I know it wasn't easy today.
No, thank you very, very much.
So well done. I think to get out there and put a message like that is such an important message to get out. Fair play to you. And if it hits home with one person, that's all that matters.
That's it. Keep our young drivers safe.
Bridget Delaney, lovely to chat to you today. And
thank
best of luck with the event.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
A big reaction there for Bridget Delaney, who is Daniel's mother, who I was talking to. As a member of the Defence Forces, Daniel was definitely part of our family. Myself and my husband will be on the Curra Plains next Sunday for Daniel and for this wonderful cause. What a heartbreaking yet uplifting interview. Daniel sounded like a lovely son, says another listener, Gemma. We were also on a completely different note talking about coffee at the top of the show, and I was saying that there's new research out where the effect of caffeine has doesn't affect your sleep like we all thought. And then Hugh has texted in, Catherine, I drink, listen to this, about 20 large mugs of instant coffee a day. I can drink a mug of coffee before I go to bed and I'll be asleep within 5 minutes. I used to drink 50 mugs a day in the Middle East and never had any trouble going to sleep. The doctors in the Middle East told me there was no issue drinking coffee as it contained water. It's interesting to note that the Road Safety Organisation are advising that if you feel tired, stop, have a cup of coffee, sleep for about 15 minutes and then resume your trip. Hugh, 50 mugs of coffee a day. 50 mugs of anything a day can't be good for you, is what I say. Anyway, lots more coming in there, but I want to move on to my next guest, because I mentioned at the start of the show that we have a dog trainer and behavioural expert, Samantha Rawson. She is on the line today. Good afternoon, Samantha.
Good afternoon, Catherine.
So now, you have 25 years experience as a canine behaviour and training consultant, is that correct?
I do.
Are the woman then that I need to talk to, and we've gotten a few doggy bad habits, listeners texting in their doggy bad habits, and and I'm not the only one, it seems. So you can keep sending them in, guys, 51551 or ray@rte.ie, and we'll see, we'll get them to Samantha and see, can she answer the questions? I don't know, Samantha, if you heard me at the top of the show about my fella.
I did.
Did you? Half three this morning. And he's not normally like that, but in recent days, he seems kind of wandering around the house and he's a little bit aggravated, and he's not normally a barker, you know, unless somebody walks past the house or, you know, somebody's at the door.
Okay, so I suppose the first question to ask is, has anything in your routine changed recently?
Not that I can put my finger on. I mean, we have a little baby, but she's 16 months, 17 months. Jeez, I don't know what age she is.
Are you going to bed earlier?
I'm going to bed earlier,
to?
Yes. Right. I'm in bed at 9 o'clock watching the 9 o'clock news. Half 10 last night was a late night for me.
Okay, and how long is that routine in place?
Oh, God, maybe 6 months, five, 6 months, yeah.
Yeah, so it's fairly established then. Mm. So usually when a dog's behaviour changes suddenly, it reflects the sudden change in the owner's routine or a sudden change in the household. And did I hear you mention that there's another dog in the house?
Yes, I have Peter and Poppy.
Peter and Poppy, right. So where is Peter when this happens? And Poppy is the one that wakes up and decides...
Oh, no, Peter. Peter is the one that... Poppy is as good as gold. She just, you know... No problem out of her. They both sleep in the same bed. We have an open plan house.
Right.
So they both sleep in their bed together under the TV, and there's never really been a problem.
Okay, so I would suggest that you give them a designated area. Open plan, it's very difficult to kind of manage a dog's behaviour if it's open plan, because he might just decide, I'm awake now and I'm bored and I want the family to wake up.
Yes.
So whereas if you give them a designated area and maybe it's kind of dark and it's den-like, then they kind of don't wake up until the family wakes up.
My partner would suggest the garden shed, but I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't go that far.
But I think maybe what's changed as well, Samantha, just thinking about it, we have baby gates now on the stairs.
Right.
Because herself is up and down now and she's on the move. So not that now I feel like I'm sort of going to get the gold star. I'll have to be put in the back of the class. But they used to come up to the stairs and sleep in the bed or on the bed or, you know, beside the bed.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe he hasn't actually accepted yet that those privileges are gone and that he doesn't have free access where he used to. So I would think of maybe even curtailing him a little bit more.
Okay.
And seeing if you can put in any... What sounds to me like it's missing is a designated area for the dogs.
Okay.
That, you know, are they there during the day? Is that where you put them when you go out shopping? You know, is that their actual area or is it only their area at night time?
It's only their area at night time.
Right, so it needs to be their area during the day as well, because if I expect a dog to behave in a certain way for 8 hours at night, I will try and implement it during the day.
Yes.
I won't suddenly expect good behaviour.
You see, and that makes sense to me actually, because us, they are spending much more time outside since she's come along.
Right.
Which I feel guilty about. We were talking about mom guilt yesterday on the show. I have dog guilt. Do you know what I mean?
I know, and it's very commonplace with mothers. I mean, when I deal with mothers, Catherine, it's just a mother's instinct to worry and to over worry, and then there are dogs as well, especially if you have a toddler, you kind of just generalise the same emotions towards the dogs.
And we were talking about
the dogs are grand.
We were talking about this upstairs, that a lot of couples, it's not unusual to, you know, get rid of your dog when a baby comes along.
That's very... I don't know. I think it's a bit of an Irish thing.
I think
it's an excuse to get rid of dogs.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't dream of it. I'd get rid of the rest of them before I get rid of them.
And I just think it's a throwback to our old Irish culture where dogs were barely allowed in the coal shed, never mind allowed in the house.
I know. But Samantha, tell me your own story. How did you get into the dog behaviour business?
I got into the dog behaviour business because way back in the early 90s, I was unemployed and I won a car. I did one of these hospital draws and I won the main prize, which was a car. And I sold the car and set up the business. And I'd actually kind of already half set up the business. Started on a moped, started on a bicycle, actually. Then graduated to a moped, then graduated to a car, then graduated to a van. And that was in 1993, May 1993. And then I used to walk dogs, I used to house it. I would do anything that people gave me money to do. And then the training was kind of getting more serious and taking off. And I went off to Southampton to study animal behaviour and was constantly in the UK. I mean, I've no more of the UK than I do of Ireland because I was constantly on dog courses. And now I just do, I do a little bit of boarding for regular dogs that I know and like, and mostly training and behaviour.
Okay. Is the, obviously the standard since the early 90s, are there dog lots of dog courses that you can do here, or good reputable courses that you do here, or there, or do you still have to go to the UK to do that?
There are a few courses here, but I suppose like anything, it's you're better off to get lots and lots of hands-on experience. So work for a rescue, you know, walk dogs, you know, just lots of hands-on, and then a bit of academia just helps you understand kind of a little bit of science behind behaviour and all that.
Okay, so when somebody comes to you, obviously not me because my dogs are completely well behaved, but if somebody comes to you, they want an assessment or they want to start training their dog, and obviously training them early is what's key. What exactly do you do?
I am looking, when somebody comes to see me, Catherine, I'm looking at the relationship between the dog and the owner. So I'm looking at how much the dog looks at the owner, how much it's curious in its environment. Does it say hello to me? You know, I've met loads of dogs that don't even say hello to me, don't greet me at all. So I'm looking for the relationship, and then
You go to the dog's home and the owner's home, so you go and see them in their natural habitat, if you like.
Yeah, so I do both. They come to me or else I'll do a house call.
Okay.
But I'm looking at the relationship between the dog and the owner, and then expectations. Sometimes expectations are too low and sometimes expectations are too high. I mean, I had a lady who wanted her dog to herd sheep, and it wasn't a herding breed. Do you know? So sometimes people's expectations can be too high. Like they want a sight hound to come back when it's called.
I get you.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So it depends on the breed, but expectations can be too low as well, where the dog is totally indulged and then they expect the dog to be perfectly behaved outside the house when it's spoiled rotten inside the house.
And so do you find that problems like dogs who are aggressive or snapping or biting or barking, do people call you too late? Or like should
you, well, it's like anything. I mean, I'm guilty of it myself, you know. Only when the car stops running do I get the mechanic to look at it.
Yes.
Do you know, so it's just human nature. We just all leave things to the very last minute, so I can't really criticise dog owners.
And do you have you obviously have dogs yourself, do you?
Or
are you like super nanny who doesn't have children? And
well, yeah, I don't have children, and I do treat the dogs a little bit like children in that I expect them to have manners.
Right.
I expect them to ask rather than demand. I mean, I don't give in to barking and I don't give in to scratching on doors. And do you know what I mean? You know, if one of my dogs wants something, they'll look at me and sit. Do you know what I mean? And if they really want something, if I'm eating a piece of toast or something, then they'll sit. If that doesn't work, they'll lie down.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
And did you say you had seven dogs?
I have seven dogs, yeah. Yeah, now they're not all planned. A bit like children, they're not planned.
You kind of pick them up as you go.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, three of them are ex-customers, actually. One I found on the roads. Two are deliverers that I went out and got. And yeah. So the last one was a customer that I went to see them, and about a week later they said the training wasn't working, but the dog was totally hyper. Now he's a nut job.
Right.
But he's cute for me. I adore him because I like his wacky side.
You like his wacky side.
Yeah, yeah.
So when it comes to owners, how much are owners to blame and how much can a dog's specific personality blame? Like you just called that dog a nut job there. I would say my dog Peter is a little different to other dogs, and since he was a puppy I could see that, you know what I mean? Whereas Poppy was very, you know, she never caused any problems, she was never barked. She was always much more obedient than him from the get-go.
Yeah, but you see, she's probably been henpecked by him a little bit as well.
Yeah.
So he's probably helped in her behaviour because he keeps her under control.
But I do think I needed to be stricter as an owner at the beginning. And I just had such a great time with them because they were so cute. And I probably didn't put as much manners on them as I should have.
Yeah, the way I kind of try and explain it to owners is it's difficult for the owner to be strict on a puppy because they're so cute and gorgeous. But if you're strict in the first year and maybe even get to 2 years, then when you have the dog you want, you can spoil it as much as you like. She sleeps in the bedroom, my older dog. You know what I mean? She sleeps under my bed. She is on the sofa. She is the queen of the household.
Yes.
Now, that's because she's an incredibly obedient dog and she's earned her stripes. The little nut job I spoke about earlier, he is not allowed upstairs. He's not allowed on the sofa because he just has no idea of what the rules are.
Right.
So I don't mind if owners spoil their dog, as long as it is at the owner's discretion and the dog has earned it in some way.
Mm. Okay, we have questions coming in. I can't hijack this and make it completely about my dog, so I'll hand it over. Therese wants to know, she said, Samantha, I have a wonderful Labrador. He's 5 years old. He's developed this new habit of running at visitors and headbutting them in their privates. Yeah. He only does this with men. It's very embarrassing, and we have done everything to get him to stop. He also has a fear of a lot of things if we're outside and the road surface changes. He freezes and he won't move. We love him very much, but this is becoming a big problem.
Okay, so labbies, I've had a few labbies over the years as boarders and clients, and they do love to stick their head in your crotch. It's a very labby thing to do. But if it's becoming embarrassing, I would keep the dog in the kitchen or to the back of the house, and I wouldn't let him greet a visitor that comes into the house for at least 20 minutes, because that changes the dynamic of the greeting and it allows the dog to calm down.
Okay.
So that's the first thing. So little things like that are up to the owner to control and manage. If you can predict a dog's behaviour, then you can manage it.
Yes. So you know that he's going to do it.
Yeah,
so
you know he's going to do it. So take some control before it happens.
Okay.
With the freezing outside, I mean, sometimes dogs will suddenly kind of stand still to look at something, or they might perceive a threat that you don't perceive. So I either stand and wait for them to kind of, that they decide it's okay, or I'll kind of walk them on a little bit and kind of move them out of the situation. But depending on the severity of it, I would tend to trust that the dog has perceived some kind of threat that I don't know about.
Okay. I have two dogs. One is a Labrador who's 10 years old. The other is a British Bulldog, 1 year old. They get on well most of the time. However, the last few months they've started fighting. We found that the trigger was food. So now we feed them separately and never have food around them. But they are fighting now all the time if me or my partner are around. Is there anything we can do?
Yeah, I would separate them, but also I wouldn't allow any unsupervised play. The young dog can be quite boisterous and they can bully an older dog into playing, and then they get a false sense of themselves. They really think they're cock of the walk because, you know, they're young and active and they're competing against an older dog, so they get a false sense of their ability. And that can become a habit, do you know what I mean?
Mm.
So he can go to the older dog and go, I want to play. And the older dog says, get lost, I don't want to play.
Mm.
And then it turns into a fight. If they've discovered it's food, the dogs are fed separately. And separately means out of eye contact of each other. So there's no point in feeding two dogs together in a corner of a room, each, you know, one in each corner. You've got to put them in two separate rooms.
Okay.
And then if the dogs are together, if this is a bit of a habit, I would be worried about the older dog, to be honest with you, because it sounds like maybe the dynamic is changing or the hierarchy is changing between the older dog and the younger dog.
Okay.
So I would, if the two of them are together, I would ignore everybody. If somebody comes into my house and all the dogs are around, they are instructed to ignore everybody. Because that way nobody is jealous, nobody is getting something that the other one isn't.
Nobody's
getting
an L cuddle when somebody else isn't.
Yeah.
Hi there, I have a one-year-old large rescue dog, mixed breed. We are struggling to walk him because he pulls so hard. Mm-hmm. Would a harness help?
It depends on the harness and it depends on the dog. I do an awful lot of lead training at home, in the house, walking around the garden, walking around the house, sitting, watching television with the dog on the lead. An awful lot of dogs think that the lead means I can pull you this way.
Mm.
When actually a lead is a limiter. A lead limits what a dog can do. It doesn't enable a dog, but most dogs don't know that. And the owners always move forward. So if somebody comes to my classes, I will ask them to stand still with the dog. If they can't stand still without the dog, you know, moving or getting them to move a foot or to move sideways, then there's no point in teaching them how to walk on a lead if they can't stand still.
If they can't stand still.
So I would start by standing still for 5 minutes and I would put the dog on the lead in the house, sit down, make a phone call, watch television. So the lead isn't always forward motion. But a harness might be the way to go, but there are loads of different harnesses, so you'd need to do some research.
Okay. My 8-month-old German Shepherd loves the car, but he yelps from when he gets in, until we get to wherever we are going. Then on the way back, he sleeps the whole way home. My 4-month-old German Shepherd is fantastic in the car. Any help, please?
Again, it's very much a Shepherd trait to scream in the car. I have a Shepherd mix myself, and she screams because they can predict that they're going for a walk. And they kind of predict very easily where they're going. So I would, if you could possibly bear it, put the dog in the car and don't go for a walk. Now, obviously, the weather is quite hot at the moment, so you've got to be careful of that one. But when the weather is okay, to maybe put the dog in the car for, you know, half an hour, 40 minutes, and don't go anywhere, and just take it out again. Again, maybe bring the dog shopping, but don't go for a walk. Do you know what I mean?
Okay, yes, get him or her used to the car.
Yeah, like my dogs don't go mad in the van because they know it doesn't always lead to a walk.
Yes.
But shepherds, again, if shepherds do scream, they are whingers and screamers, so it's very much a shepherd trait. So if the younger one hasn't learned it, I would be careful not to have them in the car together because the younger one could learn it.
What sort of a car do you have that fits seven dogs?
Well, I have a van.
Right.
So, you know, most professional dog handlers have vans. So that cuts down on the stimulations because the dogs don't see where they're going.
Okay. Samantha, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you and a revelation. I just now have to figure out where I'm going to put my dog tonight in a cordoned area and see how I get on. I might get back in touch with you to let you know how I fared.
And use it during the day, Catherine. It has to be implemented during the day.
Okay. God, as if you haven't enough going on. Samantha, Rawson, lovely chatting to you. Back after this.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Keep your texts coming in to 51551 and your emails to ray@rte.ie. Now, cool camps are fast becoming part of the fabric of summer for many Irish parents. But yesterday, Ireland's first ever autistic cool camp took place in Wexford Park. For more on this, I'm joined by Ray Harris, who's the Games Development Manager with Wexford GAA, and by Marie Banville, who is mom of Alex, one of the kids who is taking part in the camp. Good afternoon, guys. Ray, I'll come to you first. This is a brilliant idea. Where did it come from and how long was it in the making?
How you doing, Catherine? It kind of came about earlier on this year when our president, Anuk Tharan, John Horan, he addressed the Senate at the start of the year, and he spoke about the importance of inclusion in GAA for all. And from there, our county chairman, Derry Kent, sat down with the president and we had a look at kind of what Wexford can do in this area. Matthew O'Hanlon, our county hurling captain, he's our joint captain there, is an ambassador for CAN, which Maria's organisation, and we decided to try and put together a plan for, along with our coaching officer Bobby Goff, for a Kellogg's cool camp for children on the autism spectrum.
Okay, brilliant. So you set it up, it took a lot of people by the sounds of it to get working on it and get it organised. You had your first day yesterday, so how did it go? How many kids turned up?
Oh, it was a really, really successful day yesterday. We had over 120 kids overall. A lot of these kids are on the autism spectrum, but there's also some siblings who came along, and I think that was a real eye-opener for us. We got to see how good the siblings are with children on the autism spectrum and how helpful they are to their parents, and how important it is that they got to come along and enjoy this week as well. I think speaking to some of the parents, they're so happy about kids can attend a cool camp together, a Kellogg's cool camp for the first time where all the kids could go together.
Absolutely. Well, Marie, I'll bring you in here. Marie Banville is also on the line. And Marie, as Ray said, you're a member of the Cottage Autism Network. So your son, Alex, went along to do the camp. Tell us, first of all, Marie, a little bit about Alex.
Hi, Catherine. Alex is 9. He attends the autism unit in Scullwar and Coolcocks here in Wexford. So he's non-verbal, and he attended the camp then yesterday, today, and hopefully tomorrow with his 3 siblings.
Okay. So for, you know, because when you talk about inclusion, and Ray talked about inclusion there, there'll be lots of children coming back to school to talking about the various camps that they were in during the summer holidays. So it was obviously really important for you and great that this was organised, that Alex could attend and could attend with his siblings.
Oh, it's brilliant. We were just talking to earlier on and we were saying, I mean, the significance of our lads having a cool camp school bag going back in September, just like the other 5,500 kids across Wexford, you know, that have done the cool camp, and how important it is to them and how important it is to their parents that they've had the opportunity to go to a cool camp just like anybody else would.
And how did your other children, you have 3 other kids, how did they all go and did they all help out at the camp? How was it for them?
They all went. The smallest, Ruby, was in the group with Alex, so she did her own thing. She's quite an independent little woman. And the others, my older 2 of them, are in separate groups. And then my older boy said to help out with the second group as well. So,
okay. And when he came back yesterday after day one, what was Alex's reaction to the whole thing?
It's all brand new. I mean, some of these kids have never held a hurl. They've never had the opportunity to be involved in the GAA before, I suppose. And it's great for him just to be out on Wexford Park itself. I mean, it's a fabulous venue to have such a good ratio of coaches to kids. I mean, the coaches are just being brilliant. Mm. They've really taken. We're all a bit apprehensive about it Monday night. I don't think myself or Ray slept, or other people either.
I know.
We didn't know how it was going to go, but it all just blended brilliantly. And I suppose it just goes to show that you just have to make subtle changes. You know, we made sure the group sizes were small. There was as much visual prompts as possible. So we have like a countdown clock. Even welcome to Cool Camp, first day, second day. The groups are all colour coded just to make it as visual as possible for the kids that do communicate a little bit differently.
Mm. And Ray, coming back to you there, did it require a certain amount of training for the trainers and the instructors at the camp to manage in a different way, it being an autistic camp and not just the Cool Camps that have been running for years?
Yeah, definitely. There was a bit of structure had to be put in place first. A lot of meetings with Maria and other ladies who helped with the training of the staff in areas such as nonverbal communication. A lot of the kids coming will be nonverbal. And we had some really good girls, Suzanne and a few other girls who helped in with the training. And I think I have to comment our coaches. They really took to this really well. There was no apprehension, really. I think the apprehension was from me and Maria. I think the coaches on their knees just couldn't wait to get going. And they've really taken to the week. And again, linking it back to the training that we had, I think they were very well prepared for the week.
Listen, we've got loads of texts coming in here. Wow, wow, wow. Well done, Wexford. The rest of the country, listen up. Autistic kids are children too and should have the same fun as other children. Although society has come a long way, we still need more educational and acknowledgement that these kids should have the opportunity. Marie, I assume you second that. And it seems to be spreading here, not just here, but word has spread to Australia as well about this.
It is. It's crazy. I just put up a post last night. One of our lovely mammies, Michelle, was taking some fab photos yesterday. And I suppose they just captured the essence of what a cool camp for kids on the spectrum looks like. You know, we had ear defenders. There was kids on the outside looking in. There was kids partaking for short periods of time, long periods of time. All mammies and daddies will be familiar with that kind of scenario. So I just think it touched the chords. I mean, the post I put up last night has reached 30,000 people. It's just crazy. Crazy.
Ray, has it achieved what you wanted?
I definitely think it has. It's probably above achieved what we were looking at. Normally in GA, we look at success as maybe, you know, winning All Ireland or winning county medals. But here, the success is that we see children having opportunities to play in our county grounds, pick up a hurdle for the first time or kick a football into the goal for the first time. And just seeing the smile on the kids' faces and the parents' faces and the feedback's been phenomenal. I think I'm nearly looking at it going, how have we not done this before?
I know.
I think it's something that we can definitely grow and grow throughout the county. I know there's a big interest throughout the country now with NGA for participation. So hopefully going forward, this is something that we see more of.
Well, listen, it's brilliant. And Marie, I hope Alex wears his Cool Camp jersey and the bag and everything with pride heading back to school. Thanks a million for coming to talk to us, Marie Banville and Ray Harris. Let's take a quick break.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Claudia Carroll has just walked into the studio. She's asking me all about the wedding. I'm like,
yeah, I want to know.
Well, I'll tell you off air. I'll tell you off air. But yeah, okay. It's getting very calm.
Well, I have to say, listeners, very calm bride-to-be in the studio today.
It's like that swan or that duck that you see on the river.
Yes,
like, looks calm,
under the
surface. But no, do you know what? It's actually, I'm surprising myself, to be honest. Yeah. Sorry, we're here having a chat, forget that you're all out there. Claudia Carroll, of course, our Fair City favourite and author. She's in studio with me today to talk about her new book.
It's
called
The Women of Primrose
Square.
Do you like the title?
Love it. And I love the
cover's
the cover is brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah. Just to tell you a little bit about it. It's basically, can I tell you, though? I have to tell you this, I'm dying to tell you. The very, very, very prologue is, it's set in a fictitious square that I made up called Primrose Square, which is, you know, kind of in my head, Pierce Square, which is like Victorian houses.
Beautiful.
But very much in the centre of Dublin.
Right.
And kind of, you know, getting gentrified, but not there yet, you know. And it's about this character, and he's called Frank, and he's just one of those middle-aged, very invisible person, Mr. Cellophane, very kind of unassuming. unassuming.
Oh, I love that.
One of
Mr.
those people
Cellophane.
That everyone kind of looks through. And he's about to turn 50. And he's never had a birthday party in his life. And he thinks, for once, I'm going to have a party. And no one will come. And I mean no one. His wife, he's got teenagers. They're like, oh, Frank, does it have to be that week? Look, we've got exams and his wife is working, and just any time except that particular week, another time. And in work, people he's worked with for decades are like, oh, sorry, no, I can't. No babysitter that night. No, away golfing. And the day of his 50th comes and he's just feeling very sad and lonely, and he doesn't even get a card. And he thinks, okay, you know, halfway through my life and it looks like no one's particularly bothered whether I'm here or not, so fine. And he goes home that night to his dark house, lets himself out of the car, goes in, house in pitch darkness, turns it on, opens the front door, surprise! And there's everybody he ever met in his whole life. Helium balloons, there's a DJ, there's birthday cake. His wife comes out and she says, I'm so sorry, we've all been telling you such lies for the last few months because we wanted it to be a surprise. And the cheering dies out slowly, and people start to look at him, and the cheering turns to total drop-dead silence. And Frank is dressed head to toe as a woman. And I'm not telling you anymore.
You see, oh, there you go. We were talking about secrets
the prologue.
At the top of the
That's
show.
The prologue.
Do you do audiobooks? I'm like totally sucked in there.
Audiobooks are so hard. I did.
You have a great
recorded
voice for
one
them.
Of my own books one time years ago. Oh, Catherine, never again.
Really?
Clelia Murphy. That's your girl for audiobooks. Marion O'Dwyer. They're the women you want, not me. It's the hardest thing I ever did, I think.
But I think even it was your way of storytelling there. You have a great way of storytelling, which is why
well, it's a
you're
book about
a best-selling
transition.
Author.
It's a book about change. And there's another character in it called
Emily.
Let's go
back to Frank. So Frank is...
Francesca. Probably the biggest transition that anyone could go through. And there's another character, he leaves his house and he ends up having to lodge with another resident of Primrose Square, who's this elderly cranky lady, and cranky people are such fun to write because, you know, I'm one myself. And she's elderly and she's just foul and she's just one of these sour old women that just hate the world. And her obsession in life, the only thing that kind of brightens her up a little bit, is she can talk about the British royal family with encyclopedic knowledge. And Frank moves in with her and they flash off each other and spar.
And I'm taking third Frank moves in because the wife
yes.
went, sorry, we just need a little break
time
from
out.
Each other. Time out.
A lot of time. And there's a third character in the mix called Emily, who's, you know, 40s, and she's a recovering alcoholic. And she's doing the 12-step program. And she's at the part where, step 8 as they call it, where you have to make a list of everyone that you may have harmed when you were abusing alcohol or drugs. And you've got to go back and atone for it, apologise, make peace, say you're sorry, learn from the past. And she's learning that she wasn't really a very nice person when she was drinking. She just wasn't a very nice person. And so I think
three
combustible people in going... Sorry, I beg your pardon?
No, I was
I
just
should let
ask
the presenter
you when,
get a word in.
No, not at all. When you're talking about somebody going through the 12-step program, in terms of research for a book like that,
the
main character you've got, Frank.
Huge.
Well, let's talk about Frank then, because you're writing about a character who's transitioning into a woman. So how sensitive do you have to be?
Incredibly,
how much research do you have to know?
One year. And it's funny, I have found in the past that... I mean, you cannot do enough research. You cannot. And I do find, like for instance, with the Emily storyline, I approached a lot of counsellors and a lot of people who work with therapy addiction in a lot of various places around Dublin who were hugely helpful. And people, I'm always amazed because I could be anyone just cold calling basically and saying, I'm researching this. Please, could I ask you a couple of questions? I have always found people are so giving of their time, you know, except for once. Can I tell you the story?
Go for it.
I was researching a character, this is years ago, and it was when in the height of the recession, and it's a character who has lived large and she has just spent, and she lived on easy credit. You know, a lot of us are guilty of that. And she just maxed out the credit cards and got into crazy debt over her head, and the economy crashes, she loses her job and she just goes to nothing and she has to, you know, get back up again.
Start again, yeah.
Because it's always interesting to write about, it's one of the themes of Women of Primrose Square, it's a quote of Eleanor Roosevelt's, and she says, a woman is a bit like a tea bag.
You don't know how strong she is until dipped in hot water. It's a good quote, isn't
it? That is brilliant.
Yeah, it's a great quote.
I love that.
Eleanor Roosevelt was a great woman.
I love that.
She's a great woman for the old quotes. But anyway, just back to this research story. And I rang up my credit card company and I just said, what if, and I meant anyone ringing up, what if, and I had to give them my name and my details and my own card details. What if, and I just said, you know, supposing I ran up, ratcheted up a ridiculous debt and I'd bought like crazy, stupid, ridiculous things on the credit card and all of a sudden I had no money to pay it. And I tell you, there was nearly squad cars in the driveway. It was like, could you stay on the line, please? Shall I just get my supervisor? Stay on the line. And it was like, hop. The call got escalated drastically. So I said, no, it's for a work of fiction.
Yeah.
But, you know, the more
the
research
work of
you
fiction,
do.
Yeah, with a work of fiction, when you're writing a character
you
like that.
You have to do the year's research. You've got
well,
it
has
to
be believable.
You've
yeah.
got to. But I remember once I was writing about a character who had, for instance, an eating disorder. And there was nothing I couldn't have told you about anorexia, about bulimia, about binge eating. I just had done so much research. I'd say 2% of it made the final cut of the book.
Yes.
But you still have to do it anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
and
but,
be safe in the knowledge that you
yeah,
have
that
armed
you've,
yourself
you've,
with
yeah,
that
and
information.
And you learn. You'd be amazed.
So
the things you learn. Liz Nugent, my pal Liz, says if you were to check her Google search history, it's things like, how do you get rid of a dead body? How, you know, and if anyone, if the police raided your house and looked, you go, no, no, it's for a book, honestly.
But when you're talking about Frank who's transitioning, who did you go to? Who did you run and past? How did you know? Unless
oh,
you,
we
you,
did a lot. Yeah,
okay.
We did. Well, I was very, very lucky in that there was someone who was on a similar, had been on a similar journey, who chose to remain anonymous, who was incredibly informative about the sort of medical end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was writing about the emotional end of it. So that was a huge, and we would meet and talk and talk and talk. And it was invaluable. And then not only that, but when at every point in the draft process, because you go through so many drafts of a book, like Women of Primrose Square, I'm looking at the finished book now. That's like maybe my seventh after seven rounds of edits.
So, and in terms of the writing,
every draft, you run it by the people who are going to proof edit, copy check. And, you know, my people who I'd been in touch with about researching, I just sent them copies all the time. Is this okay? Is this accurate? Is this, is there
so
anything?
So is that a and year in the making?
A year. Oh, yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Wow,
one
okay.
year. Yeah, 1 year. So I liken it to doing, it's my 16th book, so I liken it to doing the Leaving Cert every year. You know that intensity of the Leaving?
16 books,
yeah.
Claudia, that is.
But it's, you know the way to Leaving? It's just
yeah,
that
yeah.
intensity. And then you finish and you deliver a book and it's like, oh my God, I don't know what to do with myself.
Six,
but you're right,
have you delivered 16 books in how many
17,
years?
17.
17.
I just delivered number 17.
Amazing.
Yes, there you go. So you're kind
what
of a year ahead.
What do you love about being an author compared to being an actor?
The power of life and death.
Definitely.
Definitely the power of life and death. But, you know, it's storytelling, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
And, you know, you've people who've got great stories that maybe would be brilliant as a movie. And I often read books and I go, or drafts of books, or people will send a couple of chapters and go, what do you think? And I go, well, this is a TV series. This should be on Netflix.
Mm.
So there's so many avenues now, I think, that weren't there when I was starting out.
Mm.
Like, for people starting out, I don't know if anyone out there has any interest in, has a story and thinks it might be a full-length novel. There are so many resources out there that weren't when I was starting. Like, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, the Writer's Centre in Parnell Square is amazing. The work they do in there is astonishing. There are courses on all the time. There's something for everyone. Now, if you want to write screenplays, if you want to write Fair City, if you want to write for, you know, a series for Netflix, away you go. There's something there. Self-publishing, that's a big avenue that's opened up now.
That's opened up in
but
a big
I always
way, yeah.
quote Maeve Binchy, the late great, and she used to say, if you're thinking of writing something, she used to say, it's highly unlikely a publisher is going to walk past your front door and knock on your door and say, hiya, Catherine, how you doing? We were just passing.
Yeah.
Would you have anything shoved in a drawer that we could just take a look at? Very
yeah.
unlikely.
Yeah.
You have to be brave and you have to get out there. But writing groups are such a boon to the whole industry generally. And it's brilliant. There's just lots of avenues now.
You have a great
there.
Story because you...
have loads of
you've
them.
Got, you've loads of great
Which
stories.
One?
But you started writing in the changing room or in your dressing
Three
room
years.
At Fair City.
Yeah, with Clell. Yeah.
So you were writing away,
Clell
scribbling.
Would be demented.
Yeah.
Yes. And we used to act out the characters. And I'd say, I'm stuck on this scene. And we'd act it. It was a great help. But 3 years.
And what was that feeling? Do you remember your first book? You obviously remember.
It was astonishing.
Published.
You never forget it. And my dad used to go into the bookshops with a camera and take photos. And it was just so cute, you know, it was just gorgeous. But, I'm not a parent, but I imagine it's how a parent must feel when, like, today I was doing book signings all around the bookshops, the M50, you know, Dundrum and Talla and the Square and Blanche and Liffey Valley, and they were all brilliant. But you walk in and you see your book on your shelf, on a shelf, and you think, that was just something, an idea that I was pitching to my agent.
And you spend so much time with it yourself.
That's another thing. I think if anyone wanted to start out, it's, you've the rise of the agent now. And an agent is amazing because they're like a matchmaker. And, you know, I had one person come to me and they said, oh my God, I'm writing this particular book. And I went to like 6 or 7 different publishers and they all said no. And it was terrible and it was really disheartening. And this person got in touch with an agent who said, well, the publishers you're approaching don't publish science fiction and you're writing science fiction. So like immediately you're not a match for each other. Mm. So they kind of will know, okay, you're writing historical fiction. So this particular editor here is looking for that. So let's put you together there. There's an awful lot more agents now.
And you've had massive success here and in the UK as well. We were talking about embarrassing moments yesterday. You were in London when you had one of those and you saw somebody buy.
Yeah, oh, I know. I'll give you a lap. No, it's
somebody
my first
buy
book,
your
I think.
Book. What's
it
your
was
first?
W. H. Smith's. And I think it was like Heathrow or Gatwick or somewhere. And a woman, there was my book on the shelf. So, of course, I'm there delighted with myself, you know, taking photos, all the rest. And a woman not only picked it up and browsed with it, but went to the till to pay for it. And this made my millennium. And I've never done it before or since. And I went up very proudly and I tapped her on the shoulder and I said, excuse me, please forgive me for interrupting you, but you see that book you have in your hand? That's me. Oh, I'm the author. Look, I can prove it to you. That's me. I wrote that book and here I am. And isn't this amazing? And she looked at me deeply unimpressed and she went, you're Cathy Kelly's, eh? No, yeah. So I said, no, I'm not Cathy Kelly.
Let me just disappear. The ground open up and swallow me. Listen, the book is called The Women of Primrose Square.
Do you like the title?
Yeah. I love it. And as I said, it's brilliant. And you've sold it to me.
Thank you, Eleanor Roosevelt, for the quote about tea bags. That was my first title, Tea Bags of Primrose Square. But my editor had to pick herself up off the floor and then, you know, it was a no.
Well, listen, as I said, it's always a pleasure to have you here.
Listen, the next time I see you.
I know, I'll be an old married woman. I just want to read one text before we go. This came in from Bridget and this is in relation to Daniel, whose mom Bridget I was speaking to throughout the show. Catherine, as a mom of two mechanics who are complete petrol heads, I have to agree with the wonderful mother you had on there. Their passion is infectious for cars, the loud exhausts, etc. They're not all as crazy as portrayed in the media. I really have huge gratitude to Bridget in portraying the good side of young drivers. And yes, she is right, local garages should provide a free check once a month for the driving youth. That's something that we are going to look into and thank you very much for that. That is all we have time for today. Mary Wilson is next on Drive Time. Claudia Carroll, thank you for coming in.
Thank you,
to have
Catherine.
A chat and I'll be back tomorrow.